I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
I want to welcome everyone to this episode of The American Idea. Today we're going to be talking about a very important figure in American history, particularly American history in the 20th century, but perhaps a figure about whom there is not as much correct, accurate, well-grounded understanding of than maybe any other figure in the 20th century, I would venture to say. That figure is Herbert Hoover. Who was Herbert Hoover? What was his importance? And what are the myths about Herbert Hoover that we might need to investigate a little bit more? And to join me for this conversation is a person who I would argue no one in the world knows more about Herbert Hoover than our guest today, George Nash. Dr. Nash is an independent scholar. He's an American historian, of course, a well-known interpreter of American political and intellectual movements, particularly American conservatism. He is a senior fellow at the Russell Kirk Center for Cultural Renewal and a widely published author. He has published a number of books, a couple that would stick out, I think, to our listeners and certainly were important for me in understanding 20th century intellectual history, one in particular, the conservative intellectual movement since 1945. He's also written multi-volume biography of the life of Herbert Hoover and is working currently, and we hope soon to complete, a volume on the relationship between Herbert Hoover and Franklin Roosevelt. Dr. Nash received his PhD from Harvard University and has been one of the most prolific and interesting scholars of American intellectual life in the 20th century. George Nash, thank you for taking the time to join us on The American Idea.
Thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Our listeners are pretty well historically informed. Of course, all Americans should have heard of the name Herbert Hoover. Our listeners certainly have, and they know something about Herbert Hoover. But just to remind us to start the conversation, can you situate Herbert Hoover in American history in the 20th century? Who was Herbert Hoover?
Well, he was born of Quaker parents in a little village in Iowa called West Branch, Iowa in 1874, was orphaned before he was 10, eventually lived with an uncle in Oregon and got admission to the so-called pioneer class, first class of Stanford University in the 1890s. There he graduated in geology and very quickly undertook a career as a mining engineer, which took him to Australia, to China, literally around the world several times before World War I, and had a first very successful career as a mining engineer and financier based largely in London, although always retaining his American affiliations, citizenship, and sense of himself. And then in 1914, he was in London when the Great War broke out, the First World War, and there were approximately 100,000 American tourists stranded in Europe, caught by all of the paralysis that ensued on the railways and so forth, trying to make their way to London and eventually back to the United States. Hoover, as an American resident of London at that time, organized a relief effort for them, just organizing passage on boats, hotel space, food relief, and so on. That was his first entrance onto what he called later the slippery slope of public life. And just to keep it brief here, his next 7 years were devoted to humanitarian work in Europe, food relief for the entire civilian population of Belgium, made him an international figure, an international humanitarian hero. When America entered the war, he added to that responsibility by becoming Woodrow Wilson's head of the U.S. Food Administration, a temporary government agency with various purposes, and then went back at Wilson's request at the end of the war to expand the relief operation from simply German-occupied Belgium to more than a dozen countries, including brand new countries like Czechoslovakia and Yugoslavia and the reconstituted Poland. So Hoover was responsible for saving millions of lives, and I can elaborate on this later if you like, and that made him really a national hero, as well as this international figure of great success in relieving people from starvation and the like. He came back to the United States, got involved in American politics, became Secretary of Commerce under Presidents Harding and Coolidge, and then in 1928, and of course everyone in this audience I'm sure knows, was elected President of the United States without ever having held an elective public office. And for 4 years, he served as president. The Great Depression developed. He became unpopular, was rejected and defeated by Franklin Roosevelt in 32. And then after a brief spell of quietness and staying off the stage, he reentered public life as what he called a crusader against collectivism, meaning the collectivism that he found distasteful in the New Deal. And from 1933 then till 1960, 31 and a half years, Hoover lived as an ex-president, longer than any other ex-president until Jimmy Carter, who just took that record a few years ago. So Hoover had a very active life, and the 4 years of the presidency were not exactly an interlude. They were a pinnacle, but they were not the complete story of his life. He spent literally 50 years in public service in the public eye, only four of which were the 4 years of the White House. And that service took the form of humanitarian work, philanthropic work, but also political and ideological opposition to what came after him, what he saw as a wrong turning in American life. And so I think what most people say to me when I relate a few of these sorts of details about his life is that most people say they didn't know that he did that much. There is a kind of fixation on that one period. Properly, he was president. Not too many people have had that position. So that is not improper to focus on, but it does, I think, miss much about the importance and the significance of Hoover's career if we don't include that larger career trajectory that he had.
Let's talk then a little bit about his life pre-presidency. As you say, it's so important for understanding Herbert Hoover's thought and his legacy. When he comes back after serving with the Woodrow Wilson administration, of course, a Democrat, Wilson, then he comes into American public life, as you said, as Secretary of Commerce in a Republican administration. What is the political situation in America, an intellectual situation at the time? Obviously, it's the progressive movement, but you still have two political parties. Where does Hoover fit in that constellation in the 1920s?
Yes, I'll just have to back up a little bit to give a proper context for answering that. Hoover came from a Republican village in small town post-Civil War Iowa, where, as he later put it, the only Democrat in the town was the town drunk.
So, unconnected facts, I'm sure.
Hoover, like many American mining engineers who were an adventurous and much-traveled bunch before World War I, Hoover, like many others in that profession, rather admired Teddy Roosevelt, who was asserting American presence on the globe and so on. And therefore, in 1912, Hoover actually gave a financial contribution to Teddy Roosevelt's Bull Moose campaign. Hoover saw himself as a progressive Republican. He joined what I think still exists today called the National Republican Club in New York City. And then when he was given the opportunity for wartime service transcending politics through the Food Administration, he left that Republican, mild Republican affiliation and served as in Woodrow Wilson's, you might say, inner cabinet. He wasn't a formal cabinet officer, but he was very much involved in the Wilsonian circle, to the point that many Democrats wanted him to run as a progressive successor to Woodrow Wilson in 1920.
Really?
Yes. When he came back from having fed the Belgians, made his reputation, and then fed much of Europe afterward, he was regarded as almost a superhero. John Maynard Keynes said he was the only person who emerged from the ordeal of Paris, meaning the Versailles Conference, with an enhanced reputation. And it was a kind of a non-political or above politics role that he had. It was not a seeking votes, you know, and so forth, running for Congress, something like that. Now, here's one of the ironies, and this: some of Hoover's friends in the Woodrow Wilson period were the Roosevelts. Roosevelt was Assistant Secretary of the Navy, and Hoover was 8 years older, but was a kind of a rising heroic star. In January of 1920, Franklin Roosevelt wrote to a friend who was also a friend of Hoover. He said, "I wish we could make Hoover president of the United States. There Wow. could not be a better one." Historians like to quote that letter. Roosevelt was at that point trying to persuade Hoover to get off of his position of being an independent progressive right after the war. Hoover said of himself that he didn't like Republican reactionaries and he didn't like Democratic radicals. I think what he actually hoped to have happen was a draft of himself by the Republicans as a progressive, Teddy Rooseveltian-leaning type Republican. I believe, on the basis of research, that Hoover might have gotten the Democratic nomination had he agreed to listen to FDR. The Democrats were desperate. Wilson was desperately ill. The party looked discredited and so forth, and they thought that this might be their salvation. So what happens? Louis Brandeis, Justice Brandeis's nephew, a man named Louis Whaley, I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, went to Roosevelt in early 1920 and said, "We Democrats are in distress, but I think I've just, here's the dream ticket. Hoover of California," that was then Hoover's residential place, "as president, and Franklin Roosevelt of New York as his running mate." And Roosevelt basically said, "Yeah, go ahead and see what you can accomplish," and so on. Now, a further irony is that Roosevelt did become the vice presidential nominee of the Democrats in 1920, but Hoover, in the meantime, had pulled away from the Democrats. Here's a little factoid as I go on here. Hoover won the New Hampshire Democratic primary in March of 1920 without ever setting foot.
Really?
And then at the end of March, he was more and more seeing himself as wanting to go in the Republican route for various reasons and that direction. But he was pro-League of Nations or ratification of the Treaty of Versailles with some reservations, which meant that he kind of broke from Wilson ultimately. But he wanted to go in that direction, and he had as his opponent in the California Republican primary, Senator Hiram Johnson, who was also running for president and who thought Hoover was just out there to block him. So that developed into quite a feud. At any rate, Hoover announces at the end of March that he wants to give California voters a choice about where they wanted America to be in the world and so forth. And so he allowed his name to be put in nomination. He got about a third of the vote, which is fairly respectable since he never went out there and he didn't have the organization that Senator Johnson had. But anyway, Hoover, a week later, after this has already happened, wins the Democratic primary in Michigan. I believe, as other historians said, if Hoover had allowed his name to go forward as a Democrat, he might quite possibly gotten the Democratic nomination, and conceivably with FDR as his running mate. But Hoover had his reasons. I think he felt closer to the Republicans. He also, I think, sensed that the Republicans were likely winners that year. Why should he put himself up as a sacrificial lamb for the Democrats? And Roosevelt and another friend were trying to get Hoover to think long term and say, "Look, you might lose this time, but you'll be head of the party," you know, that kind of argument. And Hoover didn't buy it. So he then became a supporter of Harding for president. Hoover's name was put in nomination. He didn't get very many votes. But Harding called him later in the campaign the smartest gink I know. Harding was very impressed by Hoover, this great manager of resources, food administrator, humanitarian, so on. So eventually Harding puts Hoover in the cabinet as a Republican nominee. By then, Hoover has returned to his pre-1914 Republican affiliation, but he went through all of that to get to that point. So I hope that helps explain the trajectory, which is quite unusual. I don't know, actually, of any other American political figure of prominence who served in one administration of one party and immediately went to the succeeding administration.
Who seemed to have won votes in the primaries in the same year of both political parties.
He never won a Republican primary, but he was unequivocally the candidate of the Ivy League. There are all these polls of faculty and students at Harvard and so on. Hoover was this nonpartisan hero. He was also a great hero to many American women whom he had mobilized in voluntary food relief efforts under the slogan, "Food will win the war." And he issued edicts, you might say, that were put up on kitchen windows and by the housewives, you know, conserve food, have meatless Tuesdays and wheatless Wednesdays, whatever, and so on. And they appreciated being given a role. So a lot of Hoover's support was from, you might say, the middle class, progressively oriented, but not necessarily ideologically progressive parts of the population. And before he officially swung to the Republicans, the New Republic wanted him for president. The New York World, which was a major Democratic newspaper at the time, wanted him for president. Roosevelt, as I indicated earlier, thought well of Hoover. So there was all this Democratic support, which, of course, was disappointed when Hoover made his choice. But he had that kind of nonpartisan strength in both parties, not enough to win him the Republican nomination. And the party chieftains feared him because he had been part of the Wilson team and therefore was suspect. And there's more to that that I won't take the time to go into. But anyway, Hoover did make that transition and was thought of as a progressive Republican. And in 1920, he defined himself as an independent progressive. And then he argued eventually that the progressive Republicans were the better body to go forward that way. And he had to overcome the opposition of the Republican old guard. And some of them wanted Andrew Mellon, you know, to become Treasury Secretary. And Harding played tough. He said, no Hoover, no Mellon. So he forced the party right wing to accept Hoover as the price they had to pay for getting Mellon as Secretary of the Treasury. Little interesting factoid. Uh-huh. So the Republican Party was split in certain ways, and Hoover came out of the moderately progressive wing, never progressive enough to really satisfy progressive Republican senators, and maybe a little too progressive to satisfy the most regular orthodox conservative-minded Republicans. So he had a kind of anomalous position there, which is part of the story of his life, really.
Well, let's a little bit then in the 1920s as it progresses, and he's Commerce Secretary, as you mentioned. What are some of the defining issues of the day for Hoover, and what are his positions on those, and how do they compare or contrast with either people in the administration or in the Democratic Party? Where is he situated as the 1920s moves on?
Well, it was said by a historian in some later years as a kind of summary of this that Hoover was too progressive for the conservatives and too conservative for the radicals. And Hoover came in and took this somnolent, relatively recently created federal agency, the Commerce Department, and turned it into this almost ubiquitous dynamo with all sorts of ideas for standardization of products, for example, development of civil aviation, changing the railroad industry. Hoover had an incredible reach. So he defined commerce, and Harding let him do this very broadly. You know, commerce affects everything. So he got the designation, someone said of him, that he was Secretary of Commerce and Undersecretary of every other department. But that didn't necessarily please the secretaries of the other departments. One of his big feuds was with Henry Wallace the Elder, who was Secretary of Agriculture. Henry Wallace's son became Franklin Roosevelt, Secretary of Agriculture, and eventually Vice President. There was one of the big issues of the 20s that divided the Republicans and created great perplexity was what to do about the ailing farm economy, which was not sharing so much, or at least as much as it thought it should, in the more general prosperity that developed as the decade wore on. And the great panacea for the farm bloc, as it eventually came to be designated, was something called the McNary-Haugen Bill. It's named after a senator and a congressman who sponsored the legislation in Congress. And it was basically going to be a plan whereby the federal government would buy up farm surpluses to keep the domestic price up and then turn around and try to dump those surpluses somewhere overseas. Calvin Coolidge was furious at that. And Hoover and Coolidge, and that's a key point in their relationship, they shared that aversion to that kind of government manipulation and management. What Hoover wanted was farm co-ops. He thought that farmers should be able to organize co-ops that was constructive and so on. And he tried to bring devices to the fore that would promote that kind of stabilization and improvement of the farm economy. So agriculture policy was a big issue that divided the prairie and progressive Republicans against the East Coast establishment, management-oriented industrialists, et cetera, in the Republican Party. And Hoover, I don't think, could have been nominated had he supported the McNary-Haugen formula. That was just heresy to the party bigwigs in the East. And remember, the Eastern states had quite a few electoral votes. New York was the biggest state that way, and Pennsylvania and so forth. So there was a tendency to think that you had to win with the Northeast and hopefully bring along the Midwest unless the farmers rebuild. So there was always this tension. How do you keep the farmers content? So Hoover, when he was nominated, promised that he would call a special session of Congress and set up a farm co-op program. And he did, to jump ahead a little bit, but that's one of the big issues. Another big issue was the question, which Hoover was at the forefront of, how do we develop the water resources of the country? Namely, the water resources of the St. Lawrence River, the Columbia River, the Colorado River in particular. And out of that came the Hoover Dam, eventually. Then there was a kind of division between Hoover and those to his left, notably Roosevelt. Roosevelt in 1928 became governor of New York, the same year that Hoover became president. And they had been friends, as I mentioned earlier. They weren't so close, but at least they were officially friendly and so on. They didn't have a lot to do with each other by that point. The issue within the St. Lawrence Seaway Project was Hoover wanted to build it so that it can increase ocean commerce to the Midwest, so the farmers could market their products more cheaply. But there came a question with developing the river. What do you do with the water power that's developed as what Hoover would regard as a sort of a side effect? Well, Roosevelt, as governor of New York, wanted the state of New York to own that. He basically wanted state socialism. In a way that, and in fact, he managed to shame the Republican legislature into approving this while Roosevelt was governor. And he insisted, therefore, that any arrangement that Hoover made with the Canadians for a treaty would include giving New York the control. Well, this led to a lot of friction with Hoover. And again, it's a complicated story, but Hoover negotiated the treaty, but it never got ratified. Not until much long after World War II was the St. Lawrence developed. But Hoover and Roosevelt were at odds. Hoover's version of how to handle the power issue, kind of the energy issue of the time, was the Hoover Dam way, which was the government would build it, but it would then sell the energy at a certain flat rate on a long-term basis to private enterprise, which could then market it. Roosevelt's model was, no, the state of New York is going to do it, and we're going to bring power to the people, and we're going to drive down the prices and stop those exploitive private power interests from taking advantage of the people. So Roosevelt made a big issue of that in the 32 campaign against Hoover. So those are two issues. And there are others at the time, prohibition and the like. But I think those are the two issues that really roiled domestic politics. And then Coolidge had his tax cutting plan. And Hoover, went along with that. But Hoover was, remember, an engineer. And engineers like to build things. And to build things, you spend money. And that became a source of some tension between Hoover and Coolidge.
That's exactly what I was going to ask about. The relationship between what people think of as a very conservative Republican, Calvin Coolidge, or at least more conservative, and then a kind of progressive Republican, Herbert Hoover, in the same administration. Both men are obviously ambitious, particularly perhaps Hoover, for further office. What was the relationship like between Calvin Coolidge and Herbert Hoover?
Well, it's a relationship that evolved, and Coolidge was called the Great Enigma at one point, and Hoover got the nickname the Great Engineer as one of many nicknames. Another one for Hoover was the Great Humanitarian, and that came in the 1920s and so forth. So Early on, they shared a lot. Hoover was, remember, Coolidge came into office while during Harding's first term. Hoover was already close to Harding, and Coolidge pledged to carry out Harding's agenda for the remainder of that term. And Hoover was very helpful to Coolidge in a lot of ways, just providing information and so on. I don't sense any great friction at that point. I think the friction began to develop a little in 25 when Hoover started getting lots of publicity as being the driving force in the administration, the man to whom everybody turns in Washington if they want to know what's really going on, the man who just has all these numbers in his head, you know, his mastery of the subject and so forth. I think that probably started to get on Coolidge's nerves, and there are some episodes that would suggest that. They did remain close, and as I indicated earlier, you know, I think very importantly for Hoover's future career, in their opposition to this big government intrusion into agriculture. Hoover actually helped ghostwrite at least one of the two Coolidge vetoes of that legislation, which did pass Congress. And the final veto, the second one, was in the spring of 28, when if Hoover had done otherwise, I don't think he could have gotten the nomination. It would have been some way to block him. That would have been too much to swallow by the Eastern political machines. They were suspicious of him as too much of a busy man, you know. And Coolidge, had some sense that Hoover was going to be more of a big spender and the like. And finally, I think that Hoover, while trying to be loyal, was a little felt a little frustrated by Coolidge, who's the boss, after all. He's the president, and he has to be a, Hoover knows that Coolidge can fire him at any moment. And so he has to be a good party man, or try to be. But eventually, I think this got on Coolidge's nerves. And in 1928, this is always cited by people who have heard a little bit about the Coolidge-Hoover story. At one point, in exasperation, Coolidge said of Hoover, "That man has given me unsolicited advice for 6 years, all of it bad." But that wasn't really true. Early on, in the early part of that relationship, they were cordial. It's later on when Coolidge thinks that Hoover is starting to get too far, maybe a little too prominent and so forth, that Coolidge sort of holds him off. And Coolidge adopts a very mysterious, detached view of the election. So people are wondering, right up to the moment of the nomination of Hoover in June of 28, is Coolidge going to run? Can he be drafted? Can we somehow twist his arm? And so on. And it never happened. And then Coolidge, after a few days, kind of sent a rather mild letter of congratulation to Hoover on his nomination. It didn't sound very warm. So people then started muttering, you know, the gossip in the political classes. Well, does Coolidge really want Hoover? What? Hoover goes out to see Coolidge in Wisconsin, where Coolidge was vacationing, and they have this news conference where Hoover says virtually nothing, and it seems like it's very awkward. But in the fall, Coolidge still hasn't said anything publicly other than pro forma, endorsement. But that wasn't what the party wanted. They wanted a fulsome endorsement. And finally, the New York Times and some other pro-Smith, L. Smith, elements, L. Smith was Hoover's Democratic opponent, began to speculate out loud that maybe Coolidge didn't really care. Well, so then Hoover and Coolidge did something that I always think we have to keep in mind when we look at this total relationship. Coolidge was a regular, a Republican regular. He was a party man. That meant a lot to him. So on the Friday, I think it was, or just maybe a few days before that, before the November 28 election, Hoover goes to Coolidge and they have a little, it's videotaped, you know, newsreel on the White House lawn. And they go through this little formality and Coolidge says, "I wish you well," and so forth. But again, it's not the overwhelming endorsement. Well, a couple days later, in a telegram, Coolidge writes, and it becomes headline news throughout the country, a fulsome endorsement of Hoover at the last minute, and says, you can't improve on it. It's one of the most effusive things Coolidge probably ever said. So he fully endorsed Hoover, maybe thinking, well, if they elect Hal Smith, that'll be a reflection on Coolidge's stewardship. So he would want a Republican to succeed him, if for that reason alone, but also because he and Hoover did agree in a lot of things, despite them differing differences of temperament and sort of philosophical orientation to some degree. In 1932, Coolidge wrote a letter, an article, I think for the Saturday Evening Post, endorsing Hoover for re-election. And then on the night before the election of 32, Coolidge went on the air in a national radio hookup of all sorts of prominent people. And Coolidge was at his home in Northampton, Massachusetts, and which Coolidge gives a classically conservative defense about Hoover. This is tried and true. I've seen him in action. He knows what he's doing. We do not just go casually for, we don't just vote for the highest bidder, which is, I suppose, a way of referring to Franklin Roosevelt, but not by name. So Coolidge does what he is, I think, by his code of political conduct, he should do, which is namely to stick with the party, even though he was pretty sure, I think, at that point that Hoover was going to lose. So I don't think they ever had a break. But there was that tension. And I think that's a kind of a long answer to your question. But as you can see, it's an evolution from closeness to distance to maybe mutual irritation, but keeping it below the surface while they go through the rituals of party loyalty and the business of getting Hoover elected and reelected, which it becomes, of course, something that Coolidge, I think, sincerely desires.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to take a moment and ask you to learn a little more about the Ashbrook Center and how you can help us continue our work with teachers, students, and citizens.
I'm Chad Kiefer, Director of Philanthropy and Strategic Partnerships here at Ashbrook. At its heart, America's story is about the lives of patriots who have given their last full measure of devotion to preserve and protect what it means to be an American. But the tragic truth is that the American story is being rewritten as one of oppression and despair. Back in 1776, the founders took a chance when they created a new government built on principles of liberty. They took a chance on America. Now I'm challenging you to do the same. Your gift to Ashbrook today reaches students, teachers, and citizens across the country, helping them to understand why America is worthy of their devotion. With so many forces eroding our history and taking away from our principles, isn't it time we give America a chance? Your investment is encouraged now more than ever. Please visit us today at ashbrook.org/support.
What about then the election in 1928? He's elected. Running against Al Smith, as you said, the Democrat from New York. He's elected. What political philosophy does he articulate that's going to guide the Hoover administration?
Hoover was, you might say, in a sense, a reform-minded conservative. He did not want to, he did not believe in laissez-faire. He made that very clear. And perhaps I should back up a bit by pointing out that in 1922, Hoover published a little book, an extended essay called American Individualism, which incidentally is in print today. The Hoover Institution, which he founded out in California, brought out a paperback version several years ago. And he argued that American individualism was an antidote to what he really found distasteful in Europe as he had seen it during and after World War I, a Europe turning to socialism, anarchism, communism, all sorts of Europe in chaos. And on the other hand, he did not want what he called laissez-faire, which he thought was an outmoded social philosophy. So to him, American individualism was a proper balance. And the key to American individualism, as Hoover saw it, was what he called the great ideal of Abraham Lincoln, the ideal of equality of opportunity, a fair chance for everyone. And that meant that government had some role, but it did not have a dictatorial role in managing or controlling the economy. But in certain ways, government could stimulate improvement. So he wanted to improve society. He didn't want to radically restructure it. And so in 1928, he called Al Smith and the Democrats supporting that St. Lawrence The state ownership of the St. Lawrence electrical byproduct wasn't yet developed, but that was in the planning stages, if you will. And he called that socialism, which angered them greatly. They thought that was a smear. And Al Smith said, well, if I'm a socialist, and Teddy Roosevelt was a socialist, and so forth. So they went back and forth. But Hoover was a person who was thought of as a reform-minded person, but without going to the extremes of the prairie radicals of his party, the nominal Republicans in name only, we might call them, to use a contemporary term, who were only nominally Republican, or weren't reliably Republican by orthodox standards, like George Norris of Nebraska and Hiram Johnson and about 10 others. And so they always distrusted Hoover as too much of a shill for big business. And of course, the big business Easterners thought this guy is too much a bureaucratic meddler. And Roosevelt had some funny statements to make in the 28 campaign, saying that if you're a businessman, you ought to be for Al Smith, because Hoover has shown himself to be this bureaucratic busybody as Secretary of Commerce and so on. And it's funny reading when you think about what Roosevelt did and stood for right. Just a few years later. And so Hoover's view was he's going to solve the farm problem through farm co-ops and encouraging farmers to organize and market better and create efficiencies and get better revenue and so forth. He wants to pursue the development of inland waterways. That was a big project. And he wanted prison reform. And indeed, if you look at it, in the first 8 or 9 months of his presidency before the crash, Hoover was pushing a number of those sorts of reforms. But they weren't what we would think as big government intrusive reforms. And then comes the crash, and Hoover's view was that American individualism is this kind of moderate centrist reforming, but not upsetting the fundamental system of the country, which he called ordered liberty, limited government, what we would call civil society. He strongly favored what he called self-government outside of government, which is an arresting phrase, I think. By that was, I think, somewhat like what Tocqueville saw in the 19th century, all these associations for improvement that Americans were so good at organizing voluntarily for good deeds, good works. They didn't rely upon a distant government to try to build everything or finance everything or whatever. And Hoover felt that the American people had shown that this kind of creative capacity, and he wanted to stimulate that. Now, how could the government do that? Well, one thing it could do, and this will sound maybe rather dull, the government could produce better statistics. And what many people don't remember is that we did not have a very good statistical database for a lot of matters until after 1930. I think it was in the 1930 census that it was one of the questions was, are you unemployed or not? Up to that point, it was guesswork. But Hoover, as Commerce Secretary, had urged all sorts of development of statistics. Why? Well, statistics can help businesses plan. They can make the business cycle less of a roller coaster. So part of his plan for encouraging prosperity was that government could bring business leaders together and trade associations, and they could kind of set the rules or adopt certain reforms, but they were not, Uncle Sam wasn't going to make them do it and be kind of a hall monitor, except if they got out of line by some kind of cheating, and so forth. He also believed in antitrust laws. He thought those were, in theory, a proper thing for keeping the economy from becoming stultified or controlled by a kind of a business oligarchy on the right. So he had those reforming impulses. And then, of course, it was all overtaken by the Depression. And maybe I should just stop. Yeah.
Well, that was my question, in fact. So then this reforming impulse obviously runs smack dab into the crash, as you mentioned, in the fall of 29. And then in 1930, 1931, 1932, Hoover has to deal with a wholly unanticipated set of deep challenges and problems. What's Hoover's response to the Great Depression?
Well, his first response, very first response, was to assure people that the stock market crash was a localized matter. It was business speculation run amok, all these people borrowing money to buy stocks and went up and up and up and came the crash. And a lot of people were stranded. But he said that the fundamentals of the economy were sound. But it quickly became apparent to him within 2 or 3 weeks, this is the fall of 29, that this was a much more of a psychological blow to the public than it seemed. It wasn't going to be localized. So what he did then was to bring in conferences of trade union leaders, railroad executives, big business leaders of all kinds, and get them to make various promises. The businesses would promise not to just do the knee-jerk thing and start cutting wages. And that unions should not do the knee-jerk thing and start striking. And he argued that government, the federal government, which is then a fraction of itself today, could speed up certain amount of construction spending for public works projects as a way of employing more people and getting some more money into the economy. Pardon me. He then took what was considered to be quite a courageous set. Now, remember, no other president in our history had really taken this kind of set of drastic measures to put himself at the head of the recovery effort. And he was quite popular for a few months. He was acclaimed by economists, business people, people pretty much across the spectrum initially for taking this leadership position. But of course, what he did was to put himself then in the position of having to take responsibility or having it ascribed to him if the results didn't improve, you see. So I would say, to be more concise about this, that for the first year or two, Hoover was more energetic than the traditional standard or expectation. But as the Depression lengthened and as certain things happened, like the great drought of 1930, which caused the loss of millions of acres in farm acreage in something like 20 states and a decrease in farm income by something like 25%. It was a terrific blow. No one could blame Hoover for that. But that introduced a different angle, which was how do you deal with relief efforts for the people whose lives have been so stressed out and disrupted? And that became an issue going forward. How should relief be managed? Should the federal government take involvement, or can the states, localities, community chests, voluntary organizations, can they, the traditional networks that Hoover loved and thought were vibrant and crucial to American success as a nation, whether those would succeed? That became a developing issue. And in 1931, came a great problems on the continent of Europe, a great bank failure in Austria, and the strong possibility that Germany might have a run on the banks. And Germany was borrowing a lot of money from American banks, which would then be out on a limb if Germany collapsed. And Hoover declared a moratorium, or got the nations to agree on a moratorium on intergovernmental debt payments and so on. So stabilizing measure for a year. And then came the British unexpectedly going off the gold standard, which set off a tsunami of effects over here. Because in those days, your dollar bill was as good as gold. If you walked into your bank and said, I got $10, I want an ounce of gold or something, the bank had to produce it. And if everybody started doing that because they're nervous about whether that bank is stable or not, then they're short, they have to close their doors. Well, I think in the month after Britain went off the gold standards, something like 500 American banks closed. Why? Because foreign investors were afraid that our dollar would be next. We might go off gold too, and they'd be holding these dollar bills. They wanted gold as a security. So they yanked their gold out of a lot of banks. And then small depositors, middle America don't have big deposits, got scared, lost confidence. And remember, Hoover's key to solving everything is to restore confidence. They start doing the same thing. So eventually Hoover has to appeal to the Congress, and the Congress goes right along with him. Took a little few weeks, but they did, to create a Reconstruction Finance Corporation as a government agency. So Hoover really crosses over from reliance on strictly local measures and the like, and having the banks kind of try to encourage their customers to be more confident and so forth. He decided that in order to change the psychology, as he would put it, you have to have governmental intervention. And that puts him in the latter part of his administration, therefore on that path toward more intervention, always not enough for the party on the left. And of course, Roosevelt by then is running for president against him. And the progressives are saying increasingly Hoover is doing too little. At first, some were a little nervous that he was doing too much, you know, early on, very early on. But as it kept going on and these external shocks occurred, Hoover became a little like Sisyphus, I have argued in a paper I've published in the Hoover Digest, the Hoover Institution Journal, now just discontinued. But that was several years ago. My argument was that Hoover in some ways was like Sisyphus. He was always pushing the boulder up the hill in the ancient Greek myth. And just as he gets to the top, it rolls back down again. And he has to start over. So he had to deal with the drought. He had to deal with the German problem. He had to deal with the British default on or going off of gold. So he had these series of shocks that just when it seemed like things had turned the corner, they got worse. So by the summer of 32, he's under considerable pressure for intervention. And again, the Congress passes a major bill, which you could say is a bridge to the New Deal. And that was, I think it was called the Emergency Relief and Construction Act of 1932, which for the first time provided federal aid to the states in the form of nominal loans of $300 million, a lot of money then, to help pay for relief. And so you then have the government stepping into that. I should back up and just say this. In the fall of 31, Hoover organized a national voluntary relief effort to raise money the old-fashioned way by community chest solicitation and so on across the country to provide funds for hospitals and unemployment relief and various measures that were increasingly desperately needed as unemployment soared and so forth. And it actually raised close to $100 million. It was the greatest voluntary effort the United States had ever seen. And Hoover went on the air, Calvin Coolidge went on the air, Al Smith was knocking on doors in New York City, urging people to, you know, to support this effort. And by historic standards, it was a great success. The problem was that the economy was so deeply in trouble by then that even that amount of money could not fulfill the need. So Hoover was driven into rising to the point of requesting government intervention for relief. But it was a loan. It was supposed to be paid back, and it was not directly to individual citizens. He always fought against that. He never changed his mind on that one. He said, you should not have the federal government giving direct money to people. It will be corrupting in a spiritual sense, you might say, creating what we would call a culture of dependency. And it would also be an invitation to political corruption, meaning party machines handing out the money and in return for votes. And those were two of the things that he most objected to in the New Deal when it came.
And of course, after he's defeated in 1932, as you say, he spends a long time after that in retirement, but still engaged in public life, considering public affairs, commenting. And in fact, wrote a book, I believe, after he's out of office, The Challenges to Liberty, where he continues to argue against what he called collectivism. What's the life and career of Herbert Hoover like once he's defeated by Franklin Roosevelt in 1932?
Well, pardon me. After taking a year off, he re-entered the public fray and engaged in what he came to call a crusade against collectivism. And he argued that that the world was being swept by ideologies of extreme statism, socialism, communism, fascism, and what he called regimentation, which was his word for the New Deal. And the book that you're referring to is The Challenge to Liberty, published in 1934, which is his kind of political philosophy manifesto in defending what he now called historic liberalism or true liberalism. And his argument was that was where he stood. He used to call it American individualism, but he came to call it historic liberalism. He was not quite happy about what the New Deal did because in terminology, because he said at one point in the mid-30s that the New Deal, having corrupted liberalism for collectivism, coercion, and the concentration of political power. He says it seems that historic liberalism, must be conservatism in contrast. And I argue that that is a kind of his moment of recognition, that he's no longer this residual progressive that he had been before 1932 in some ways. He'd been outflanked on his left by more statist-minded progressives who appropriated the name liberal. And so he had to access, he wanted to go with historic liberalism, but he recognized that it was, in effect, he was now a man of the right. And he devotes a great deal of time in the 30s, 40s to critiquing the New Deal and sees it as creeping socialism, creeping collectivism. He has a number of terms like that. And he says that we really have three ways we can relate the government to the economy. You can have just pure laissez-faire, no government relation to the economy, which he rejected consistently. Or you can have government as umpire, which was his view of what government should be, making rules but not choosing favorites. But he said the other alternative is either government dictation or government control of enterprise. If it's government control, he would call that socialism or communism. If it's government direction or dictation, that's fascism. Fascists kept the companies, but they told them what to do. So he says the middle road there, what he would see as a middle road, was his preference. So from that somewhat Hayekian standpoint, I would say, if I may use the name Friedrich Hayek in this connection, Hoover becomes a critic of the New Deal. Now, he and Roosevelt both have a sense of the stakes that are here, because Roosevelt sees the New Deal as a great break with this rotten past, and so the great failures of the old order. And Hoover sees the New Deal as a great step, but in the wrong direction. And so what they end up having is a kind of a long-distance argument through their speeches and their supporters' speeches and so on, about what went wrong between 1929 and eventually 1941, when the economy rebounded under war stimulation and so on, got back to a kind of a pre-1929 level. What went wrong in that period? Was capitalism at fault? And was the New Deal approach the solution? Or was it the reverse? Was the New Deal one that worsened the projects, worsened the problems, and therefore they have this debate which resonates to this time. And Hoover saw this coming, and I should make this point, in one of his great speeches in 1932, re-election speech, October 31st, 1932, in Madison Square Garden, he says, "This election is more than a contest between two men. It's more than a contest between two parties. It's a contest between two philosophies of government, and its outcome will determine the fate of the country for a century to come." He says that. He later said that was one of the most prophetic things he ever wrote or stated. So he sees this contest in very ideological terms and commits himself not to just going off and playing golf and staying out of the limelight and living a quiet life as an ex-president, but he sees himself as a warrior, really, a crusader against what he sees as this fundamental wrong turning. Now, along the way, he gets involved in other matters. He is a great philanthropist. He heads up the Boys Club movement for almost 30 years. He develops the Hoover Institution into what he wanted it to become, ultimately a think tank. And he said in 1960, just before he died, that the Hoover Institution he thought was his most important contribution to American life. It was a remarkable thing to say, because he thought it had a didactic function. Yeah. Here were the records of mankind's failings and mistakes, errors, and so on, failures of collectivism, communism, revolutions abroad, etc. And so he saw it as this great repository that could educate the American people. And I think that he saw himself, therefore, as a great teacher He would be in the what we might call the classical liberal wing of what became this multi-pronged conservative movement coalition after World War II. I think he'd be closest to that, but he became also a kind of grandfather figure in developing the anti-New Deal coalition that became conservatism. And he gave Buckley a certain amount of help, William F. Buckley, in founding National Review. And Hoover was a kind of, I'd say, a kind of benevolent grandfather figure, the grand old man who fought the fight and never gave in and so on. One other thing I should mention in talking about his later career, he tries to become a humanitarian again in World War II. And he did succeed to some extent in providing a certain measure of food relief to Poland in the very opening months of the war, and especially to Finland after it got invaded by Russia in 1939 and 40. And he tried to expand his operations to German-occupied countries, but Roosevelt and Churchill thought that would not help win the war, and they blocked him. So he was very frustrated by that. But he did other things to refurbish his humanitarian image. And I have to say this, it's been said by someone else, and I think it's true. If you look at all of the millions of people whom Hoover's food efforts supported, saved from starvation in World War I, the population of Belgium, other countries after the war, Soviet Russia, where 10 million or more people were fed by Hoover Relief in the early 20s, even though it was a communist regime. If you add up all those numbers, I think you would have to conclude, as has been said before of him, that he was responsible in that way for saving more lives than any person who had ever lived.
Fascinating, insightful look at the life and legacy and thought of perhaps a misunderstood, important person in American history. Herbert Hoover. George Nash, thank you for taking the time to join us today for this illuminating conversation on the American idea.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.